Little Men, Life at Plumfield with Joe's Boys. Chapter 1. Nat. "Please, sir, is this Plumfield?" asked a ragged boy of the man who opened the great gate at which the omnibus left him.
"Yes. Who sent you?"
"Mr. Lawrence. I have got a letter for the lady."
"All right, go up to the house, and give it to her, she'll see to you, little chap."
The man spoke pleasantly, and the boy went on, feeling much cheered by the words. Through the soft spring rain that fell on sprouting grass and budding trees, Nat saw a large square house before him, a hospitable-looking house, with an old-fashioned porch, wide steps, and lights shining in many windows. Neither curtains nor shutters hid the cheerful glimmer, and, pausing a moment before he rang, Nat saw many little shadows dancing on the walls, heard the pleasant hum of young voices, and felt that it was hardly possible that the light and warmth and comfort within could be for a homeless little chap like him. "I hope the lady will see to me," he thought, and gave a timid rap with a great bronze knocker, which was a jovial griffin's head. A rosy-faced servant maid opened the door, and smiled as she took the letter which he silently offered. She seemed used to receiving strange boys, for she pointed to a seat in the hall, and said, with a nod, "Sit there and drip on the mat a bit, while I take this into Mrs." Nat found plenty to amuse him while he waited, and stared about him curiously, enjoying the view, yet glad to do so unobserved in the dusky recess by the door. The house seemed swarming with boys, who were beguiling the rainy twilight with all sorts of amusements. There were boys everywhere, upstairs and downstairs and in the ladies' chamber, apparently, for various open doors showed pleasant groups of big boys, little boys, and middle-sized boys in all stages of evening relaxation, not to say effervescence. Two large rooms on the right were evidently schoolrooms, for desks, maps, blackboards, and books were scattered about. An open fire burned on the hearth, and several indolent lads lay on their backs before it, discussing a new cricket ground, with such animation that their boots waved in the air. A tall youth was practicing on the flute in one corner, quite undisturbed by the racket all about him. Two or three others were jumping over the desks, pausing, now and then, to get their breath and laugh at the droll sketches of a little wag who was caricaturing the whole household on a blackboard. In the room on the left, a long supper table was seen, set forth with great pitchers of new milk, piles of brown and white bread, and perfect stacks of the shiny gingerbread so dear to boyish souls. A flavor of toast was in the air, also suggestions of baked apples, very tantalizing to one hungry little nose and stomach. The hall, however, presented the most inviting prospect of all, for a brisk game of tag was going on in the upper entry. One landing was devoted to marbles, the other to checkers, while the stairs were occupied by a boy reading, a girl singing a lullaby to her doll, two puppies, a kitten, and a constant succession of small boys sliding down the banisters, to the great detriment of their clothes and danger to their limbs. So absorbed did Nat become in this exciting race, that he ventured farther and farther out of his corner, and when one very lively boy came down so swiftly that he could not stop himself, but fell off the banisters, with a crash that would have broken any head but one rendered nearly as hard as a cannonball by 11 years of constant bumping, Nat forgot himself, and ran up to the fallen rider, expecting to find him half dead. The boy, however, only winked rapidly for a second, then lay calmly looking up at the new face with a surprised, "Hello."
"Hello," returned Nat, not knowing what else to say, and thinking that form of reply both brief and easy.
"Are you a new boy?" asked the recumbent youth, without stirring.
"Don't know yet."
"What's your name?"
"Nat Blake."
"Mine's Tommy Bangs. Come up and have a go, will you?" And Tommy got upon his legs like one suddenly remembering the duties of hospitality.
"Guess I won't, till I see whether I'm going to stay or not," returned Nat, feeling the desire to stay increase every moment.
"I say, Demi, here's a new one. Come and see to him," and the lively Thomas returned to his sport with unabated relish. At his call, the boy reading on the stairs looked up with a pair of big brown eyes, and after an instant's pause, as if a little shy, he put the book under his arm, and came soberly down to greet the newcomer, who found something very attractive in the pleasant face of this slender, mild-eyed boy.
"Have you seen Aunt Jo?" he asked, as if that was some sort of important ceremony.
"I haven't seen anybody yet but you boys, I'm waiting," answered Nat.
"Did Uncle Lori send you?" proceeded Demi, politely, but gravely.
"Mr. Lawrence did. He is Uncle Lori, and he always sends nice boys." Nat looked gratified at the remark, and smiled, in a way that made his thin face very pleasant. He did not know what to say next, so the two stood staring at one another in friendly silence,
till the little girl came up with her doll in her arms. She was very like to me, only not so tall, and had a rounder, rosier face, and blue eyes. "This is my sister, Daisy," announced to me, as if presenting a rare and precious creature. The children nodded to one another, and the little girl's face dimpled with pleasure, as she said affably, "I hope you'll stay. We have such good times here, don't we, Demi?" "Of course, we do, that's what Aunt Jo has Plumfield for." "It seems a very nice place indeed," observed Nat, feeling that he must respond to these amiable young persons. "It's the nicest place in the world, isn't it, Demi?" said Daisy, who evidently regarded her brother as authority on all subjects. "No, I think Greenland, where the icebergs and seals are, is more interesting. But I'm fond of Plumfield, and it is a very nice place to be in," returned Demi, who was interested just now in a book on Greenland. He was about to offer to show Nat the pictures and explain them, when the servant returned, saying with a nod toward the parlor door, "All right, you are to stop. I'm glad, now come to Aunt Jo." And Daisy took him by the hand with a pretty protecting air, which made Nat feel at home at once. Demi returned to his beloved book, while his sister led the newcomer into a back room, where a stout gentleman was frolicking with two little boys on the sofa, and a thin lady was just finishing the letter which she seemed to have been rereading. "Here he is, Auntie," cried Daisy. "So this is my new boy? I am glad to see you, my dear, and hope you'll be happy here," said the lady, drawing him to her, and stroking back the hair from his forehead with a kind hand and a motherly look, which made Nat's lonely little heart yearn toward her. She was not at all handsome, but she had a merry sort of face that never seemed to have forgotten certain childish ways and looks, any more than her voice and manner had, and these things, hard to describe but very plain to see and feel, made her a genial, comfortable kind of person, easy to get on with, and generally jolly, as boys would say. She saw the little tremble of Nat's lips as she smoothed his hair, and her keen eyes grew softer, but she only drew the shabby figure nearer and said, laughing, "I am Mother Bear, that gentleman is Father Bear, and these are the two little bears. Come here, boys, and see Nat." The three wrestlers obeyed at once, and the stout man, with the chubby child on each shoulder, came up to welcome the new boy. Rob and Teddy merely grinned at him, but Mr. Bear shook hands, and pointing to a low chair near the fire, said, in a cordial voice, "There is a place all ready for thee, my son, sit down and dry thy wet feet at once." "Wet? So they are. My dear, off with your shoes this minute, and I'll have some dry things ready for you in a jiffy," cried Mrs. Bear, bustling about so energetically that Nat found himself in the cozy little chair, with dry socks and warm slippers on his feet, before he would have had time to say Jack Robinson, if he had wanted to try. He said "thank you, ma'am," instead, and said it so gratefully that Mrs. Bear's eyes grew soft again, and she said something merry, because she felt so tender, which was a way she had. "There are Tommy Banks' slippers, but he never will remember to put them on in the house, so he shall not have them. They are too big, but that's all the better, you can't run away from us so fast as if they fitted." "I don't want to run away, ma'am." And Nat spread his grimy little hands before the comfortable blaze, with a long sigh of satisfaction. "That's good. Now I am going to toast you well, and try to get rid of that ugly cough. How long have you had it, dear?" asked Mrs. Bear, as she rummaged in her big basket for a strip of flannel. "All winter. I got cold, and it wouldn't get better, somehow. No wonder, living in the damp cellar with hardly a rag to his poor dear back," said Mrs. Bear, in a low tone to her husband, who was looking at the boy with a skillful pair of eyes that marked the thin temples and feverish lips, as well as the hoarse voice and frequent fits of coughing that shook the bent shoulders under the patched jacket. "Robin, my man, trot up to Nursey, and tell her to give thee the cough bottle and the liniment," said Mr. Bear, after his eyes had exchanged telegrams with his wife's. Nat looked a little anxious at the preparations, but forgot his fears in a hearty laugh, when Mrs. Bear whispered to him, with a droll look, "Hear my rogue Teddy try to cough. The syrup I'm going to give you has honey in it, and he wants some." Little Ted was red in the face with his exertions by the time the bottle came, and was allowed to suck the spoon after Nat had manfully taken a dose and had the bit of flannel put about his throat. These first steps toward a cure were hardly completed when a great bell rang, and a loud tramping through the hall announced supper. Bashful Nat quaked at the thought of meeting many strange boys, but Mrs. Bear held out her hand to him, and Rob said, patronizingly, "Don't be afraid, I'll take care of you." 12 boys, 6 on a side, stood behind their chairs, prancing with impatience to begin, while the tall flute-playing youth was trying to curb their ardor. But no one sat down till Mrs. Bear was in her place behind the teapot, with Teddy on her left, and Nat on her right. "This is our new boy, Nat Blake. After supper you can say how do you do? Gently, boys, gently." As she spoke everyone stared at Nat, and then whisked into their seats, trying to be orderly and failing utterly. The Bears did their best to have the lads behave well at meal times, and generally succeeded pretty well, for their rules were few and sensible, and the boys, knowing that they tried to make things easy and happy, did their best to obey. But there are times when hungry boys cannot be repressed without real cruelty, and Saturday evening, after a half holiday, was one of those times. Dear little souls, do let them have one day in which they can howl and racket and frolic to their heart's content. A holiday isn't a holiday without plenty of freedom and fun, and they shall have full swing once a week, Mrs. Bear used to say, when prim people wondered why banister sliding, pillow fights, and all manner of jovial games were allowed under the once decorous roof of Plumfield. It did seem at times as if the aforesaid roof was in danger of flying off, but it never did, for a word from Father Bear could at any time produce a lull, and the lads had learned that liberty must not be abused. So, in spite of many dark predictions, the school flourished, and manners and morals were insinuated, without the pupils exactly knowing how it was done. Nat found himself very well off behind the tall pitchers, with Tommy Bangs just around the corner, and Mrs. Bear close by to fill up plate and mug as fast as he could empty them. "Who is that boy next to the girl down at the other end?" whispered Nat to his young neighbor under cover of a general laugh. "That's Demi Brooke. Mr. Bear is his uncle. What a queer name. His real name is John, but they call him Demi John, because his father is John too. That's a joke, don't you see?" said Tommy, kindly explaining. Nat did not see, but politely smiled, and asked, with interest, "Isn't he a very nice boy?" "I bet you he is, knows lots and reads like anything. Who is the fat one next him?" "Oh, that's Stuffy Cole. His name is George, but we call him Stuffy 'cause he eats so much. The little fellow next Father Bear is his boy Rob, and then there's Big Franz his nephew, he teaches some, and kind of sees to us. He plays the flute, doesn't he?" asked Nat as Tommy rendered himself speechless by putting a whole baked apple into his mouth at one blow. Tommy nodded, and said, sooner than one would have imagined possible under the circumstances, "Oh, don't he, though? And we dance sometimes, and do gymnastics to music. I like a drum myself, and mean to learn as soon as ever I can. I like a fiddle best, I can play one too," said Nat, getting confidential on this attractive subject. "Can you?" And Tommy stared over the rim of his mug with round eyes, full of interest. "Mr. Bear's got an old fiddle, and he'll let you play on it if you want to." "Could I? Oh, I would like it ever so much. You see, I used to go round fiddling with my father, and another man, till he died." "Wasn't that fun?" cried Tommy, much impressed. "No, it was horrid, so cold in winter, and hot in summer. And I got tired, and they were cross sometimes, and I didn't get enough to eat." Nat paused to take a generous bite of gingerbread, as if to assure himself that the hard times were over, and then he added regretfully, "But I did love my little fiddle, and I miss it. Nequala took it away when Father died, and wouldn't have me any longer, 'cause I was sick." "You'll belong to the band if you play good. See if you don't." "Do you have a band here?" Nat's eyes sparkled. "Guess we do, a jolly band, all boys, and they have concerts and things. You just see what happens tomorrow night." After this pleasantly exciting remark, Tommy returned to his supper, and Nat sank into a blissful reverie over his full plate. Mrs. Bear had heard all they said, while apparently absorbed in filling mugs, and overseeing little Ted, who was so sleepy that he put his spoon in his eye, nodded like a rosy poppy, and finally fell fast asleep, with his cheek pillowed on a soft bun. Mrs. Bear had put Nat next to Tommy, because that roly-poly boy had a frank and social way with him, very attractive to shy persons. Nat felt this, and had made several small confidences during supper, which gave Mrs. Bear the key to the new boy's character, better than if she had talked to him herself. In the letter which Mr. Lawrence had sent with Nat, he had said, "Dear Joe, here is a case after your own heart. This poor lad is an orphan now, sick and friendless. He has been a street musician, and I found him in a cellar, mourning for his dead father, and his lost violin. I think there is something in him, and have a fancy that between us we may give this little man a lift. You cure his overtasked body, Fritz help his neglected mind, and when he is ready I'll see if he is a genius or only a boy with a talent which may earn his bread for him. Give him a trial, for the sake of your own boy. Teddy." Of course we will, cried Mrs. Bear, as she read the letter, and when she saw Nat she felt at once that, whether he was a genius or not, here was a lonely, sick boy who needed just what she loved to give, a home and motherly care. Both she and Mr. Bear observed him quietly, and in spite of ragged clothes, awkward manners, and a dirty face, they saw much about Nat that pleased them. He was a thin, pale boy, of 12, with blue eyes, and a good forehead under the rough, neglected hair, an anxious, scared face, at times, as if he expected hard words, or blows, and a sensitive mouth that trembled when a kind glance fell on him, while a gentle speech called up a look of gratitude, very sweet to see. Bless the poor dear, he shall fiddle all day long if he likes, said Mrs. Bear to herself, as she saw the eager, happy expression on his face when Tommy talked of the band. So, after supper, when the lads flocked into the schoolroom for more hijinks, Mrs. Joe appeared with a violin in her hand, and after a word with her husband, went to Nat, who sat in a corner watching the scene with intense interest. Now, my lad, give us a little tune. We want a violin in our band, and I think you will do it nicely. She expected that he would hesitate, but he seized the old fiddle at once, and handled it with such loving care, it was plain to see that music was his passion. I'll do the best I can, ma'am, was all he said, and then drew the bow across the strings, as if eager to hear the dear notes again. There was a great clatter in the room, but as if deaf to any sounds but those he made, Nat played softly to himself, forgetting everything in his delight. It was only a simple Negro melody, such as street musicians play, but it caught the ears of the boys at once, and silenced them, till they stood listening with surprise and pleasure. Gradually they got nearer and nearer, and Mr. Bear came up to watch the boy, for, as if he was in his element now, Nat played away and never minded anyone, while his eyes shone, his cheeks reddened, and his thin fingers flew, as he hugged the old fiddle and made it speak to all their hearts the language that he loved. A hearty round of applause rewarded him better than a shower of pennies, when he stopped and glanced about him, as if to say, I've done my best, please like it. I say, you do that first rate, cried Tommy, who considered Nat his protege. You shall be the first fiddle in my band, added Franz, with an approving smile. Mrs. Bear whispered to her husband. Teddy is right, there's something in the child. And Mr. Bear nodded his head emphatically, as he clapped Nat on the shoulder, saying, heartily. You play well, my son. Come now and play something which we can sing. It was the proudest, happiest minute of the poor boy's life when he was led to the place of honor by the piano, and the lads gathered round, never heeding his poor clothes, but eyeing him respectfully and waiting eagerly to hear him play again. They chose a song he knew, and after one or two false starts they got going, and violin, flute, and piano led a chorus of boyish voices that made the old roof ring again. It was too much for Nat, more feeble than he knew, and as the final shout died away, his face began to work, he dropped the fiddle, and turning to the wall sobbed like a little child. My dear, what is it? Asked Mrs. Bear, who had been singing with all her might, and trying to keep little Rob from beating time with his boots. You are all so kind and it's so beautiful I can't help it, sobbed Nat, coughing till he was breathless. Come with me, dear, you must go to bed and rest, you are worn out, and this is too noisy a place for you, whispered Mrs. Bear, and took him away to her own parlor, where she let him cry himself quiet. Then she won him to tell her all his troubles, and listen to the little story with tears in her own eyes, though it was not a new one to her. My child, you have got a father and a mother now, and this is home. Don't think of those sad times anymore, but get well and happy, and be sure you shall never suffer again, if we can help it. This place is made for all sorts of boys to have a good time in, and to learn how to help themselves and be useful men, I hope. You shall have as much music as you want, only you must get strong first. Now come up to Nursie and have a bath, and then go to bed, and tomorrow we will lay some nice little plans together. Nat held her hand fast in his, but had not a word to say, and let his grateful eyes speak for him, as Mrs. Bear led him up to a big room, where they found a stout German woman with a face so round and cheery that it looked like a sort of sun, with the wide frill of her cap for rays. This is Nursie Hummel, and she will give you a nice bath, and cut your hair, and make you all comfy, as Rob says. That's the bathroom in there, and on Saturday nights we scrub all the little lads first, and pack them away in bed before the big ones get through singing. Now then, Rob, in with you. As she talked, Mrs. Bear had whipped off Rob's clothes and popped him into a long bathtub in a little room opening into the nursery. There were two tubs, besides foot baths, basins, douche pipes, and all manner of contrivances for cleanliness. Nat was soon luxuriating in the other bath, and while simmering there, he watched the performances of the two women, who scrubbed, cleaned, nightgowned, and bundled into bed four or five small boys, who, of course, cut up all sorts of capers during the operation, and kept everyone in a gale of merriment till they were extinguished in their beds. By the time Nat was washed and done up in a blanket by the fire, while Nursey cut his hair, a new detachment of boys arrived and were shut into the bathroom, where they made as much splashing and noise as a school of young whales at play. Nat had better sleep here, so that if his cough troubles him in the night you can see that he takes a good draught of flaxseed tea, said Mrs. Bear, who was flying about like a distracted hen with a large brood of lively ducklings. Nursey approved the plan, finished Nat off with a flannel nightgown, a drink of something warm and sweet, and then tucked him into one of the three little beds standing in the room, where he lay looking like a contented mummy and feeling that nothing more in the way of luxury could be offered him. Cleanliness in itself was a new and delightful sensation. Flannel gowns were unknown comforts in his world. Sips of good stuff soothed his cough as pleasantly as kind words did his lonely heart, and the feeling that somebody cared for him made that plain room seem a sort of heaven to the homeless child. It was like a cozy dream, and he often shut his eyes to see if it would not vanish when he opened them again. It was too pleasant to let him sleep, and he could not have done so if he had tried, for in a few minutes one of the peculiar institutions of Plumfield was revealed to his astonished but appreciative eyes. A momentary lull in the aquatic exercises was followed by the sudden appearance of pillows flying in all directions, hurled by white goblins, who came rioting out of their beds. The battle raged in several rooms, all down the upper hall, and even surged at intervals into the nursery, when some hard-pressed warrior took refuge there. No one seemed to mind this explosion in the least, no one forbade it, or even looked surprised. Nursey went on hanging up towels, and Mrs. Bear laid out clean clothes, as calmly as if the most perfect order reigned. Nay, she even chased one daring boy out of the room, and fired after him the pillow he had slyly thrown at her. "Won't they hurt him?" asked Nat, who lay laughing with all his might. "Oh dear, no. We always allow one pillow fight Saturday night. The cases are changed tomorrow, and it gets up a glow after the boys' baths, so I rather like it myself," said Mrs. Bear, busy again among her dozen pairs of socks. "What a very nice school this is," observed Nat, in a burst of admiration. "It's an odd one," laughed Mrs. Bear, "but you see we don't believe in making children miserable by too many rules, and too much study. I forbade nightgown parties at first, but, bless you, it was of no use. I could no more keep those boys in their beds than so many jacks in the box. So I made an agreement with them, I was to allow a 15-minute pillow fight every Saturday night, and they promised to go properly to bed every other night. I tried it, and it worked well. If they don't keep their word, no frolic. If they do, I just turn the glasses round, put the lamps in safe places, and let them rampage as much as they like." "It's a beautiful plan," said Nat, feeling that he should like to join in the fray, but not venturing to propose it the first night. So he lay enjoying the spectacle, which certainly was a lively one. Tommy Bangs led the assailing party, and Amy defended his own room with a dogged courage fine to see, collecting pillows behind him as fast as they were thrown, till the besiegers were out of ammunition, when they would charge upon him in a body, and recover their arms. A few slight accidents occurred, but nobody minded, and gave and took sounding thwacks with perfect good humor, while pillows flew like big snowflakes, till Mrs. Bear looked at her watch, and called out, "Time is up, boys. Into bed, every man Jack, or pay the forfeit." "What is the forfeit?" asked Nat, sitting up in his eagerness to know what happened to those wretches who disobeyed this most peculiar, but public-spirited school, ma'am. "Lose their fun next time," answered Mrs. Bear. "I give them 5 minutes to settle down, then put out the lights, and expect order. They are honorable lads, and they keep their word." That was evident, for the battle ended as abruptly as it began, a parting shot or two, a final cheer, as Demi fired the seventh pillow at the retiring foe, a few challenges for next time, then order prevailed. And nothing but an occasional giggle or a suppressed whisper broke the quiet which followed the Saturday night frolic, as Mother Bear kissed her new boy and left him to happy dreams of life at Plumfield. Chapter 2. The Boys. While Nat takes a good long sleep, I will tell my little readers something about the boys, among whom he found himself when he woke up. To begin with our old friends. Franz was a tall lad, of 16 now, a regular German, big, blonde, and bookish, also very domestic, amiable, and musical. His uncle was fitting him for college, and his aunt for a happy home of his own hereafter, because she carefully fostered in him gentle manners, love of children, respect for women, old and young, and helpful ways about the house. He was her right-hand man on all occasions, steady, kind, and patient, and he loved his Mary Ant like a mother, for such she had tried to be to him. Emil was quite different, being quick-tempered, restless, and enterprising, bent on going to sea, for the blood of the old Vikings stirred in his veins, and could not be tamed. His uncle promised that he should go when he was 16, and set him to studying navigation, gave him stories of good and famous admirals and heroes to read, and let him lead the life of a frog in river, pond, and brook, when lessons were done. His room looked like the cabin of a man of war, for everything was nautical, military, and ship-shape. Captain Kidd was his delight, and his favorite amusement was to rig up like that piratical gentleman, and roar out sanguinary sea songs at the top of his voice. He would dance nothing but sailor's hornpipes, rolled in his gait, and was as nautical in conversation to his uncle would permit. The boys called him Commodore, and took great pride in his fleet, which whitened the pond and suffered disasters that would have daunted any commander but a sea-struck boy. Demi was one of the children who show plainly the effect of intelligent love and care, for soul and body worked harmoniously together. The natural refinement which nothing but home influence can teach, gave him sweet and simple manners. His mother had cherished an innocent and loving heart in him, his father had watched over the physical growth of his boy, and kept the little body straight and strong on wholesome food and exercise and sleep, while Grandpa March cultivated the little mind with the tender wisdom of a modern Pythagoras, not tasking it with long, hard lessons, parrot learned, but helping it to unfold as naturally and beautifully as sun and dew help roses bloom. He was not a perfect child, by any means, but his faults were of the better sort, and being early taught the secret of self-control, he was not left at the mercy of appetites and passions, as some poor little mortals are, and then punished for yielding to the temptations against which they have no armor. A quiet, quaint boy was Demi, serious, yet cheery, quite unconscious that he was unusually bright and beautiful, yet quick to see and love intelligence or beauty in other children. Very fond of books, and full of lively fancies, born of a strong imagination and his spiritual nature, these traits made his parents anxious to balance them with useful knowledge and healthful society, lest they should make him one of those pale precocious children who amaze and delight a family sometimes, and fade away like hothouse flowers, because the young soul blooms too soon, and has not a hardy body to root it firmly in the wholesome soil of this world. So Demi was transplanted to Plumfield, and took so kindly to the life there, that Meg and John and Grandpa felt satisfied that they had done well. Mixing with other boys brought out the practical side of him, roused his spirit, and brushed away the pretty cobwebs he was so fond of spinning in that little brain of his. To be sure, he rather shocked his mother when he came home, by banging doors, saying by George emphatically, and demanding tall thick boots that clumped like papa's. But John rejoiced over him, laughed at his explosive remarks, got the boots, and said contentedly, "He is doing well, so let him clump. I want my son to be a manly boy, and this temporary roughness won't hurt him. We can polish him up by and by, and as for learning, he will pick that up as pigeons do peas. So don't hurry him." Daisy was as sunshiny and charming as ever, with all sorts of womanlinesses budding in her, for she was like her gentle mother, and delighted in domestic things. She had a family of dolls, whom she brought up in the most exemplary manner. She could not get on without her little work basket and bits of sewing, which she did so nicely, that Demi frequently pulled out his handkerchief to display her neat stitches, and baby Josie had a flannel petticoat beautifully made by Sister Daisy. She liked to quiddle about the china closet, prepare the salt cellars, put the spoons straight on the table, and every day went round the parlor with her brush, dusting chairs and tables. Demi called her a Betty, but was very glad to have her keep his things in order, lend him her nimble fingers in all sorts of work, and help him with his lessons, for they kept abreast there, and had no thought of rivalry. The love between them was as strong as ever, and no one could laugh Demi out of his affectionate ways with Daisy. He fought her battles valiantly, and never could understand why boys should be ashamed to say right out that they loved their sisters. Daisy adored her twin, thought my brother the most remarkable boy in the world, and every morning, in her little wrapper, trotted to tap at his door with a motherly get up, "My dear, it's most breakfast time, and here's your clean collar." Rob was an energetic morsel of a boy, who seemed to have discovered the secret of perpetual motion, for he never was still. Fortunately, he was not mischievous, nor very brave, so he kept out of trouble pretty well, and vibrated between father and mother like an affectionate little pendulum with a lively dick, for Rob was a chatterbox. Teddy was too young to play a very important part in the affairs of Plumfield, yet he had his little sphere, and filled it beautifully. Everyone felt the need of a pet at times, and baby was always ready to accommodate, for kissing and cuddling suited him excellently. Mrs. Joe seldom stirred without him, so he had his little finger in all the domestic pies, and everyone found them all the better for it, for they believed in babies at Plumfield. Dick Brown, and Adolphus or Dolly Petingle, were 2 8-year-olds. Dolly stuttered badly, but was gradually getting over it, for no one was allowed to mock him and Mr. Bear tried to cure it, by making him talk slowly. Dolly was a good little lad, quite uninteresting and ordinary, but he flourished here, and went through his daily duties and pleasures with placid content and propriety. Dick Brown's affliction was a crooked back, yet he bore his burden so cheerfully, that Demi once asked in his queer way, "Do humps make people good-natured? I'd like one if they do." Dick was always merry, and did his best to be like other boys, for a plucky spirit lived in the feeble little body. When he first came, he was very sensitive about his misfortune, but soon learned to forget it, for no one dared remind him of it, after Mr. Bear had punished one boy for laughing at him. "God don't care, for my soul is straight if my back isn't," sobbed Dick to his tormentor on that occasion, and, by cherishing this idea, the bear soon led him to believe that people also loved his soul, and did not mind his body, except to pity and help him to bear it. Playing menagerie once with the others, someone said, "What animal will you be, Dick?" "Oh, I'm the dromedary, don't you see the hump on my back?" was the laughing answer. "So you are, my nice little one that don't carry loads, but marches by the elephant first in the procession," said Demi, who was arranging the spectacle. "I hope others will be as kind to the poor dear as my boys have learned to be," said Mrs. Joe, quite satisfied with the success of her teaching, as Dick ambled past her, looking like a very happy, but a very feeble little dromedary, beside stout Stuffy, who did the elephant with ponderous propriety. Jack Ford was a sharp, rather a sly lad, who was sent to this school, because it was cheap. Many men would have thought him a smart boy, but Mr. Bear did not like his way of illustrating that Yankee word, and thought his unboyish keenness and money-loving as much of an affliction as Dolly's stutter, or Dick's hump. Ned Barker was like 1,000 other boys of 14, all legs, blunder, and bluster. Indeed, the family called him the blunderbuss, and always expected to see him tumble over the chairs, bump against the tables, and knock down any small articles near him. He bragged a good deal about what he could do, but seldom did anything to prove it, was not brave, and a little given to tale-telling. He was apt to bully the small boys, and flatter the big ones, and without being at all bad, was just the sort of fellow who could very easily be led astray. George Cole had been spoilt by an overindulgent mother, who stuffed him with sweetmeats till he was sick, and then thought him too delicate to study, so that at 12 years old, he was a pale, puffy boy, dull, fretful, and lazy. A friend persuaded her to send him to Plumfield, and there he soon got waked up, for sweet things were seldom allowed, much exercise required, and study made so pleasant, that Stuffy was gently lured along, till he quite amazed his anxious mama by his improvement, and convinced her that there was really something remarkable in Plumfield air. Billy Ward was what the Scotch tenderly call an innocent, for though 13 years old, he was like a child of 6. He had been an unusually intelligent boy, and his father had hurried him on too fast, giving him all sorts of hard lessons, keeping at his book 6 hours a day, and expecting him to absorb knowledge as a Strasbourg goose does the food crammed down its throat. He thought he was doing his duty, but he nearly killed the boy, for a fever gave the poor child a sad holiday, and when he recovered, the overtasked brain gave out, and Billy's mind was like a slate over which a sponge has passed, leaving it blank. It was a terrible lesson to his ambitious father. He could not bear the sight of his promising child, changed to a feeble idiot, and he sent him away to Plumfield, scarcely hoping that he could be helped, but sure that he would be kindly treated. Quite docile and harmless was Billy, and it was pitiful to see how hard he tried to learn, as if groping dimly after the lost knowledge which had cost him so much. Day after day, he pored over the alphabet, proudly said A and B, and thought that he knew them, but on the morrow they were gone, and all the work was to be done over again. Mr. Bear had infinite patience with him, and kept on in spite of the apparent hopelessness of the task, not caring for book lessons, but trying gently to clear away the mists from the darkened mind, and give it back intelligence enough to make the boy less a burden and an affliction. Mrs. Bear strengthened his health by every aid she could invent, and the boys all pitied and were kind to him. He did not like their active plays, but would sit for hours watching the doves, would dig holes for Teddy till even that ardent grubber was satisfied, or follow Silas, the man, from place to place seeing him work, for honest C was very good to him, and though he forgot his letters Billy remembered friendly faces. Tommy Bangs was the scapegrace of the school, and the most trying scapegrace that ever lived. As full of mischief as a monkey, yet so good-hearted that one could not help forgiving his tricks, so scatterbrained that words went by him like the wind, yet so penitent for every misdeed, that it was impossible to keep sober when he vowed tremendous vows of reformation, or proposed all sorts of queer punishments to be inflicted upon himself. Mr. and Mrs. Bear lived in a state of preparation for any mishap, from the breaking of Tommy's own neck, to the blowing up of the entire family with gunpowder, and Nursey had a particular drawer in which she kept bandages, plasters, and salves for his especial use, for Tommy was always being brought in half dead, but nothing ever killed him, and he arose from every downfall with redoubled vigor. The first day he came, he chopped the top off one finger in the hay cutter, and during the week, fell from the shed roof, was chased by an angry hen who tried to pick his out because he examined her chickens, got run away with, and had his ears boxed violent by Asia, who caught him luxuriously skimming a pan of cream with half a stolen pie. Undaunted, however, by any failures or rebuffs, this indomitable youth went on amusing himself with all sorts of tricks till no one felt safe. If he did not know his lessons, he always had some droll excuse to offer, and as he was usually clever at his books, and as bright as a button in composing answers when he did not know them, he'd go on pretty well at school. But out of school, ye gods and little fishes! How Tommy did carouse! He wound fat Asia up in her own clothesline against the post, and left her there to fume and scold for half an hour one busy Monday morning. He dropped a hot scent down Mary Ann's back as that pretty maid was waiting at table one day when there were gentlemen to dinner, whereat the poor girl upset the soup and rushed out of the room in dismay, leaving the family to think that she had gone mad. He fixed a pail of water up in a tree, with a bit of ribbon fastened to the handle, and when Daisy, attracted by the gay streamer, tried to pull it down, she got a douche bath that spoiled her clean frock and hurt her little feelings very much. He put rough white pebbles in the sugar bowl when his grandmother came to tea, and the poor old lady wondered why they didn't melt in her cup, but was too polite to say anything. He passed around snuff in church so that five of the boys sneezed with such violence they had to go out. He dug paths in winter time, and then privately watered them so that people should tumble down. He drove poor Silas nearly wild by hanging his big boots in conspicuous places, for his feet were enormous, and he was very much ashamed of them. He persuaded confiding little Dolly to tie a thread to one of his loose teeth, and leave the string hanging from his mouth when he went to sleep, so that Tommy could pull it out without his feeling the dreaded operation. But the tooth wouldn't come at the first tweak, and poor Dolly woke up in great anguish of spirit, and lost all faith in Tommy from that day forth. The last prank had been to give the hens bread soaked in rum, which made them tipsy and scandalized all the other fowls, for the respectable old biddies went staggering about, pecking and clucking in the most maudlin manner, while the family were convulsed with laughter at their antics, till Daisy took pity on them and shut them up in the hen house to sleep off their intoxication. These were the boys and they lived together as happy as 12 lads could, studying and playing, working and squabbling, fighting faults and cultivating virtues in the good old-fashioned way. Boys at other schools probably learned more from books, but less of that better wisdom which makes good men. Latin, Greek, and mathematics were all very well, but in Professor Bear's opinion, self-knowledge, self-help, and self-control were more important, and he tried to teach them carefully. People shook their heads sometimes at his ideas, even while they owned that the boys improved wonderfully in manners and morals. But then, as Mrs. Joe said to Nat, it was an odd school. Chapter 3. Sunday. The moment the bell rang next morning Nat flew out of bed, and dressed himself with great satisfaction in the suit of clothes he found on the chair. They were not new, being half-worn garments of one of the well-to-do boys, but Mrs. Bear kept all such cast-off feathers for the picked robins who strayed into her nest. They were hardly on when Tommy appeared in a high state of clean collar, and escorted Nat down to breakfast. The sun was shining into the dining room on the well-spread table, and the flock of hungry, hearty lads who gathered round it. Nat observed that they were much more orderly than they had been the night before, and everyone stood silently behind his chair while little Rob, standing beside his father at the head of the table, folded his hands, reverently bent his curly head, and softly repeated a short grace in the devout German fashion, which Mr. Bear loved and taught his little son to honor. Then they all sat down to enjoy the Sunday morning breakfast of coffee, steak, and baked potatoes, instead of the bread and milk fare with which they usually satisfied their young appetites. There was much pleasant talk while the knives and forks rattled briskly, for certain Sunday lessons were to be learned, the Sunday walk settled, and plans for the week discussed. As he listened, Nat thought it seemed as if this day must be a very pleasant one, for he loved quiet, and there was a cheerful sort of hush over everything that pleased him very much, because, in spite of his rough life, The boy possessed the sensitive nerves which belong to a music-loving nature. "Now, my lads, get your morning jobs done, and let me find you ready for church when the bus comes round," said Father Bear, and set the example by going into the schoolroom to get books ready for the morrow. Everyone scattered to his or her task, for each had some little daily duty, and was expected to perform it faithfully. Some brought wood and water, brushed the steps, or ran errands for Mrs. Bear. Others fed the pet animals, and did chores about the barn with Franz. Daisy washed the cups, and Demi wiped them, for the twins liked to work together, and Demi had been taught to make himself useful in the little house at home. Even baby Teddy had his small job to do, and trotted to and fro, putting napkins away, and pushing chairs into their places. For half an hour the lads buzzed about like a hive of bees, then the bus drove round, Father Bear and Franz with the eight older boys piled in, and away they went for a 3-mile drive to church in town. Because of the troublesome cough, Nat preferred to stay at home with the four small boys, and spent a happy morning in Mrs. Bear's room, listening to the stories she read them, learning the hymns she taught them, and then quietly employing himself pasting pictures into an old ledger. "This is my Sunday closet," she said, showing him shelves filled with picture books, paint boxes, architectural blocks, little diaries, and materials for letter writing. "I want my boys to love Sunday, to find it a peaceful, pleasant day, when they can rest from common study and play, yet enjoy quiet pleasures, and learn, in simple ways, lessons more important than any taught in school. Do you understand me?" she asked, watching Nat's attentive face. "You mean to be good?" he said, after hesitating a minute. "Yes, to be good, and to love to be good. It is hard work sometimes, I know very well, but we all help one another, and so we get on. This is one of the ways in which I try to help my boys," and she took down a thick book, which seemed half full of writing, and opened at a page on which there was one word at the top. "Why, that's my name," cried Nat, looking both surprised and interested. "Yes, I have a page for each boy. I keep a little account of how he gets on through the week, and Sunday night I show him the record. If it is bad I am sorry and disappointed, if it is good I am glad and proud, but, whichever it is, the boys know I want to help them, and they try to do their best for love of me and Father Bear." "I should think they would," said Nat, catching a glimpse of Tommy's name opposite his own, and wondering what was written under it. Mrs. Bear saw his eye on the words, and shook her head, saying, as she turned a leaf, "No, I don't show my records to any but the one to whom each belongs. I call this my conscience book, and only you and I will ever know what is to be written on the page below your name. Whether you will be pleased or ashamed to read it next Sunday depends on yourself. I think it will be a good report, at any rate. I shall try to make things easy for you in this new place, and shall be quite contented if you keep our few rules, live happily with the boys, and learn something." "I'll try, ma'am," and Nat's thin face flushed up with the earnestness of his desire to make Mrs. Bear glad and proud, not sorry and disappointed. "It must be a great deal of trouble to write about so many," he added, as she shut her book with an encouraging pat on the shoulder. "Not to me, for I really don't know which I like best, writing or boys," she said, laughing to see Nat stare with astonishment at the last item. "Yes, I know many people think boys are a nuisance, but that is because they don't understand them. I do, and I never saw the boy at whom I could not get on capitally with after I had once found the soft spot in his heart. Bless me, I couldn't get on at all without my flock of dear, noisy, naughty, harum-scarum little lads, could I, my Teddy?" And Mrs. Bear hugged the young rogue, just in time to save the big inkstand from going into his pocket. Nat, who had never heard anything like this before, really did not know whether Mother Bear was a trifle crazy, or the most delightful woman he had ever met. He rather inclined to the latter opinion, in spite of her peculiar tastes, for she had a way of filling up a fellow's plate before he asked, of laughing at his jokes, gently tweaking him by the ear, or clapping him on the shoulder, that Nat found very engaging. "Now, I think you would like to go into the schoolroom and practice some of the hymns we are to sing tonight," she said, rightly guessing the thing of all others that he wanted to do. Alone with the beloved violin and the music book propped up before him in the sunny window, while spring beauty filled the world outside, and Sabbath silence reigned within, Nat enjoyed an hour or two of genuine happiness, learning the sweet old tunes, and forgetting the hard past in the cheerful present. When the churchgoers came back and dinner was over, everyone read, wrote letters home, said their Sunday lessons, or talked quietly to one another, sitting here and there about the house. At 3 o'clock the entire family turned out to walk, For all the active young bodies must have exercise, and in these walks the active young minds were taught to see and love the providence of God in the beautiful miracles which nature was working before their eyes. Mr. Bear always went with them, and in his simple, fatherly way, found for his flock, sermons in stones, books in the running brooks, and good in everything. Mrs. Bear with Daisy and her own two boys drove into town, to pay the weekly visit to Grandma, which was busy Mother Bear's one holiday and greatest pleasure. Nat was not strong enough for the long walk, and asked to stay at home with Tommy, who kindly offered to do the honors of Plumfield. "You've seen the house, so come out and have a look at the garden, and the barn, and the menagerie," said Tommy, when they were left alone with Asia, to see that they didn't get into mischief, for, though Tommy was one of the best-meaning boys who ever adorned knickerbockers, accidents of the most direful nature were always happening to him, no one could exactly tell how. "What is your menagerie?" asked Nat, as they trotted along the drive that encircled the house. "We all have pets, you see, and we keep them in the corn barn, and call it the menagerie. Here you are. Isn't my guinea pig a beauty?" And Tommy proudly presented one of the ugliest specimens of that pleasing animal that Nat ever saw. "I know a boy with a dozen of them, and he said he'd give me one, only I hadn't any place to keep it, so I couldn't have it. It was white, with black spots, a regular rouser, and maybe I could get it for you if you'd like it," said Nat, feeling it would be a delicate return for Tommy's attentions. "I'd like it ever so much, and I'll give you this one, and they can live together if they don't fight. Those white mice are Rob's, Franz gave them to him. The rabbits are Ned's, and the bantams outside are Stuffy's. That box thing is Demi's turtle tank, only he hasn't begun to get them yet. Last year he had 62, whackers some of them. He stamped one of them with his name and the year, and let it go, and he says maybe he will find it ever so long after and know it. He read about a turtle being found that had a mark on it that showed it must be hundreds of years old. Demi's such a funny chap." "What is in this box?" asked Nat, stopping before a large deep one, half full of earth. "Oh, that's Jack Ford's worm shop. He digs heaps of them and keeps them here, and when we want any to go fishing with, we buy some of him. It saves lots of trouble, only he charged too much for them. Why, last time we traded I had to pay 2 cents a dozen, and then got little ones. Jack's mean sometimes, and I told him I'd dig for myself if he didn't lower his prices. Now, I own two hens, those gray ones with top knots, first-rate ones they are too, and I sell Mrs. Bear the eggs, but I never ask her more than 25 cents a dozen, never. I'd be ashamed to do it," cried Tommy, with a glance of scorn at the worm shop. "Who owns the dogs?" asked Nat, much interested in these commercial transactions, and feeling that T. Bangs was a man whom it would be a privilege and a pleasure to patronize. "The big dog is Emil's. His name is Christopher Columbus. Mrs. Bear named him because she likes to say Christopher Columbus, and no one minds it if she means the dog," answered Tommy, in the tone of a showman displaying his menagerie. "The white pup is Rob's, and the yellow one is Teddy's. A man was going to drown them in our pond, and Pa Bear wouldn't let him. They do well enough for the little chaps, I don't think much of them myself. Their names are Castor and Pollux. I'd like Toby the donkey best, if I could have anything. It's so nice to ride, and he's so little and good," said Nat, remembering the weary tramps he had taken on his own tired feet. "Mr. Lorry sent him out to Mrs. Bear, so she shouldn't carry Teddy on her back when we go to walk. We're all fond of Toby, and he's a first-rate donkey, sir. Those pigeons belong to the whole lot of us, we each have our pet one, and go shares in all the little ones as they come along. Squabs are great fun, there ain't any now, but you can go up and take a look at the old fellows, while I see if Cockletop and Granny have laid any eggs." Nat climbed up a ladder, put his head through a trapdoor and took a long look at the pretty doves billing and cooing in their spacious loft. Some on their nests, some bustling in and out, and some sitting at their doors, while many went flying from the sunny housetop to the straw-strewn farmyard, where 6 sleek cows were placidly ruminating. "Everybody has got something but me. I wish I had a dove, or a hen, or even a turtle, all my own," thought Nat, feeling very poor as he saw the interesting treasures of the other boys. "How do you get these things?" he asked, when he joined Tommy in the barn. "We find 'em or buy 'em, or folks give 'em to us. My father sends me mine, but as soon as I get egg money enough, I'm going to buy a pair of ducks. There's a nice little pond for 'em behind the barn, and people pay well for duck eggs, and the little duckies are pretty, and it's fun to see 'em swim," said Tommy, with the air of a millionaire. Nat sighed, for he had neither father nor money, nothing in the wide world but an old empty pocketbook, and the skill that lay in his 10 fingertips. Tommy seemed to understand the question and the sigh which followed his answer, for after a moment of deep thought, he suddenly broke out. "Look here, I'll tell you what I'll do. If you'll hunt eggs for me, I hate it, I'll give you one egg out of every dozen. You keep a count, and when you've had 12, Mother Bear will give you 25 cents for 'em, and then you can buy what you like, don't you see?"
"I'll do it.
What a kind feller you are, Tommy," cried Nat, quite dazzled by this brilliant offer.
"Pooh. That is not anything. You begin now and rummage the barn, and I'll wait here for you. Granny is cackling, so you're sure to find one somewhere," and Tommy threw himself down on the hay with a luxurious sense of having made a good bargain, and done a friendly thing. Nat joyfully began his search, and went rustling from loft to loft till he found two fine eggs, one hidden under a beam, and the other in an old peck measure, which Mrs. Cockletop had appropriated.
"You may have one and I'll have the other, that will just make up my last dozen, and tomorrow we'll start fresh. Here, you chalk your accounts up near mine, and then we'll be all straight," said Tommy, showing a row of mysterious figures on the side of an old winnowing machine. With a delightful sense of importance, the proud possessor of one egg opened his account with his friend, who laughingly wrote above the figures these imposing words: "T-Bangs and Company." Poor Nat found them so fascinating that he was with difficulty persuaded to go and deposit his first piece of portable property in Asia's storeroom. Then they went on again, and having made the acquaintance of the two horses, six cows, three pigs, and one Alderney Bossy, as calves are called in New England, Tommy took Nat to a certain old willow tree that overhung a noisy little brook. From the fence it was an easy scramble into a wide niche between the three big branches, which had been cut off to send out from year to year a crowd of slender twigs, till a green canopy rustled overhead. Here little seats had been fixed, and a hollow place a closet made big enough to hold a book or two, a dismantled boat, and several half-finished whistles.
"This is Demise and my private place, we made it, and nobody can come up unless we let 'em, except Daisy, we don't mind her," said Tommy, as Nat looked with delight from the babbling brown water below to the green arch above, where bees were making a musical murmur as they feasted on the long yellow blossoms that filled the air with sweetness.
"Oh, it's just beautiful," cried Nat. "I do hope you'll let me up sometimes. I never saw such a nice place in all my life. I'd like to be a bird, and live here always."
"It is pretty nice. You can come if Tommy don't mind, and I guess he won't, because he said last night that he liked you."
"Did he?"
And Nat smiled with pleasure, for Demi's regard seemed to be valued by all the boys, partly because he was Father Bear's nephew, and partly because he was such a sober, conscientious little fellow.
"Yes, Demi likes quiet chaps, and I guess he and you'll get on if you care about reading as he does."
Poor Nat's flush of pleasure deepened to a painful scarlet at those last words, and he stammered out,
"I can't read very well, I never had any time, I was always fiddling round, you know. I don't love it myself, but I can do it well enough when I want to," said Tommy, after a surprised look, which said as plainly as words, "A boy 12 years old and can't read."
"I can read music, anyway," added Nat, rather ruffled at having to confess his ignorance.
"I can't," and Tommy spoke in a respectful tone, which emboldened Nat to say firmly,
"I mean to study real hard and learn everything I can, for I never had a chance before.
Does Mr. Bear give hard lessons?"
"No, he isn't a bit cross, he sort of explains and gives you a boost over the hard places. Some folks don't, my other master didn't. If we missed a word, didn't we get raps on the head?"
And Tommy rubbed his own pate as if it tingled yet with a liberal supply of raps, the memory of which was the only thing he brought away after a year with his other master.
"I think I could read this," said Nat, who had been examining the books.
"Read a bit, then, I'll help you," resumed Tommy, with a patronizing air.
So Nat did his best, and floundered through a page with May friendly boosts from Tommy, who told him he would soon go it as well as anybody. Then they sat and talked boy fashion about all sorts of things, among others, gardening, for Nat, looking down from his perch, asked what was planted in the many little patches lying below them on the other side of the brook.
"These are our farms," said Tommy. "We each have our own patch, and raise what we like in it, only have to choose different things, and can't change till the crop is in, and we must keep it in order all summer."
"What are you going to raise this year?"
"Wall, I catalated to have beans, as they are about the easiest crop a going."
Nat could not help laughing, for Tommy had pushed back his hat, put his hands in his pockets, and drawled out his words in unconscious imitation of Silas, the man who managed the place for Mr. Bear.
"Come, you needn't laugh, beans are ever so much easier than corn or potatoes. I tried melons last year,
But the bugs were a bother, and the old things wouldn't get ripe before the frost, so I didn't have but one good water and two little mushmelons, said Tommy, relapsing into a silicism with the last word.
Corn looks pretty growing, said Nat, politely, to atone for his laugh.
Yes, but you have to hoe it over and over again. Now, 6 weeks beans only have to be done once or so, and they get ripe soon. I'm going to try 'em, for I spoke first. Stuffy wanted 'em, but he's got to take peas, they only have to be picked, and he ought to do it, he eats such a lot.
I wonder if I shall have a garden? Said Nat, thinking that even corn hoeing must be pleasant work.
Of course you will, said a voice from below, and there was Mr. Bear returned from his walk, and come to find them, for he managed to have a little talk with every one of the lads sometime during the day, and found that these chats gave them a good start for the coming week. Sympathy is a sweet thing, and it worked wonders here, for each boy knew that Father Bear was interested in him, and some were readier to open their hearts to him than to a woman, especially the older ones, who liked to talk over their hopes and plans, man to man. When sick or in trouble they instinctively turned to Mrs. Joe, while the little ones made her their mother confessor on all occasions. In descending from their nest, Tommy fell into the brook, being used to it. He calmly picked himself out and retired to the house to be dried. This left Nat to Mr. Bear, which was just what he wished, and, during the stroll they took among the garden plots, he won the lad's heart by giving him a little farm, and discussing crops with him as gravely as if the food for the family depended on the harvest. From this pleasant topic they went to others, and Nat had many new and helpful thoughts put into a mind that received them as gratefully as the thirsty earth had received the warm spring rain. All supper time he brooded over them, often fixing his eyes on Mr. Bear with an inquiring look, that seemed to say, "I like that, do it again, sir." I don't know whether the man understood the child's mute language or not, but when the boys were all gathered together in Mrs. Bear's parlor for the Sunday evening talk, he chose a subject which might have been suggested by the walk in the garden. As he looked about him, Nat thought it seemed more like a great family than a school, for the lads were sitting in a wide half-circle round the fire, some on chairs, some on the rug, Daisy and Demi on the knees of Uncle Fritz, and Rob snugly stowed away in the back of his mother's easy chair, where he could not unseen if the talk got beyond his depth. Everyone looked quite comfortable, and listened attentively, for the long walk made rest agreeable, and as every boy there knew that he would be called upon for his views, he kept his wits awake to be ready with an answer. "Once upon a time," began Mr. Bear, in the dear old-fashioned way, "there was a great and wise gardener who had the largest garden ever seen. A wonderful and lovely place it was, and he watched over it with the greatest skill and care, and raised all manner of excellent and useful things. But weeds would grow even in this fine garden. Often the ground was bad and the good seed sown and it would not spring up. He had many undergardeners to help him. Some did their duty and earned the rich wages he gave them, but others neglected their parts and let them run to waste, which displeased him very much. But he was very patient, and for thousands and thousands of years he worked and waited for his great harvest. He must have been pretty old," said Demi, who was looking straight into Uncle Fritz's face, as if to catch every word.
"Hush, Demi, it's a fairy story," whispered Daisy.
"No, I think it's an origuri," said Demi.
"What is origuri?"
called out Tommy, who was of an inquiring turn.
"Tell him, Demi, if you can, and don't use words unless you are quite sure you know what they mean," said Mr. Bear.
"I do know, Grandpa told me. A fable is a origuri, it's a story that means something. My story without an end is one, because the child in it means a soul, don't it, Auntie?" cried Demi, eager to prove himself right.
"That's it, dear, and Uncle's story is an allegory, I am quite sure, so listen and see what it means," returned Mrs. Joe, who always took part in whatever was going on, and enjoyed it as much as any boy among them. Demi composed himself, and Mr. Bear went on in his best English, for he had improved much in the last 5 years, and said the boys did it. This great gardener gave a dozen or so of little plots to one of his servants, and told him to do his best and see what he could raise. Now this servant was not rich, nor wise, nor very good, but he wanted to help because the gardener had been very kind to him in many ways. So he gladly took the little plots and fell to work. They were all sorts of shapes and sizes, and some were very good soil, some rather stony, and all of them needed much care, for in the rich soil the weeds grew fast, and in the poor soil there were many stones.
"What was growing in them besides the weeds, and stones?" asked Nat, so interested, he forgot his shyness and spoke before them all.
"Flowers," said Mr. Bear, with a kind look. "Even the roughest, most neglected little bed had a bit of heartsease or a sprig of mignonette in it.
One had roses, sweet peas, and daisies in it. Here he pinched the plump cheek of the little girl leaning on his arm. Another had all sorts of curious plants in it, bright pebbles, a vine that went climbing up like Jack's beanstalk, and many good seeds just beginning to sprout, for, you see, this bed had been taken fine care of by a wise old man, who had worked in gardens of this sort all his life. At this part of the Irigaray, Demi put his head on one side like an inquisitive bird, and fixed his bright eye on his uncle's face, as if he suspected something and was on the watch. But Mr. Bear looked perfectly innocent, and went on glancing from one young face to another, with a grave, wistful look, that said much to his wife, who knew how earnestly he desired to do his duty in these little garden plots. As I tell you, some of these beds were easy to cultivate, that means to take care of Daisy, and others were very hard. There was one particularly sunshiny little bed that might have been full of fruits and vegetables as well as flowers, only it wouldn't take any pains, and when the man sowed, well, we'll say melons in this bed, they came to nothing, because the little bed neglected them. The man was sorry, and kept on trying, though every time the crop failed, all the bed said, was, "I forgot." Here a general laugh broke out, and everyone looked at Tommy, who had pricked up his ears at the word melons, and hung down his head at the sound of his favorite excuse. "I knew he meant us," cried Demi, clapping his hands. "You're the man, and we are the little gardens, aren't we, Uncle Fritz? You have guessed it. Now each of you tell me what crop I shall try to sow in you this spring, so that next autumn I may get a good harvest out of my 13 plots," said Mr. Bear, nodding at Nat as he corrected himself. "You can't sow corn and beans and peas in us. Unless you mean we are to eat a great many and get fat," said Stuffy, with a sudden brightening of his round, dull face as the pleasing idea occurred to him. "He don't mean that kind of seeds. He means things to make us good, and the weeds are false," cried Demi, who usually took the lead in these talks, because he was used to this sort of thing, and liked it very much. "Yes, each of you think what you need most, and tell me, and I will help you to grow it, only you must do your best, or you will turn out like Tommy's melons, all leaves and no fruit. I will begin with the oldest, and ask the mother what she will have in her plot, for we are all parts of the beautiful garden, and may have rich harvests for our master if we love him enough," said Father Bear. "I shall devote the whole of my plot to the largest crop of patience I can get, for that is what I need most," said Mrs. Joe, so soberly that the lads fell to thinking in good earnest what they should say when their turns came, and some among them felt a twinge of remorse, that they had helped to use up Mother Bear's stock of patience so fast. Franz wanted perseverance, Tommy steadiness, Ned went in for good temper, Daisy for industry, Demi for as much wiseness as Grandpa, and Nat timidly said he wanted so many things he would let Mr. Bear choose for him. The others chose much the same things, and patience, good temper, and generosity seemed the favorite crops. One boy wished to like to get up early, but did not know what name to give that sort of seed, and poor Stuffy sighed out, "I wish I loved my lessons as much as I do my dinner, but I can't. We will plant self-denial, and hoe it and water it, and make it grow so well that next Christmas no one will get ill by eating too much dinner. If you exercise your mind, George, it will get hungry just as your body does, and you will love books almost as much as my philosopher here," said Mr. Bear, adding, as he stroked the hair off Tommy's fine forehead, "You are greedy also, my son, and you like to stuff your little mind full of fairy tales and fancies, as well as George likes to fill his little stomach with cake and candy. Both are bad, and I want you to try something better. Arithmetic is not half so pleasant as Arabian Nights, I know, but it is a very useful thing, and now is the time to learn it, else you will be ashamed and sorry by and by. But, Harry and Lucy, and Frank, are not fairy books, and they are all full of barometers, and bricks, and shoeing horses, and useful things, and I'm fond of them, ain't I, Daisy?" said Demi, anxious to defend himself. "So they are, but I find you reading Roland and Maybird a great deal oftener than Harry and Lucy, and I think you are not half so fond of Frank as you are of Sinbad. Come, I shall make a little bargain with you both. George shall eat but 3 times a day, and you shall read but 1 storybook a week, and I will give you the new cricket ground, only, you must promise to play in it," said Uncle Fritz, in his persuasive way, for Stuffy hated to run about, and Demi was always reading in play hours. "But we don't like cricket," said Demi. "Perhaps not now, but you will when you know it. Besides, you do like to be generous, and the other boys wanted to play, and you can give them the new ground if you choose." This was taking them both on the right side, and they agreed to the bargain, to the great satisfaction of the rest.
There was a little more talk about the gardens, and then they all sang together. The band delighted Nat, for Mrs. Bear played the piano, Franz the flute, Mr. Bear a bass viol, and he himself the violin. A very simple little concert, but all seemed to enjoy it, and old Asia, sitting in the corner, joined at times with the sweetest voice of any, for in this family, master and servant, old and young, black and white, shared in the Sunday song, which went up to the father of them all. After this they each shook hands with Father Bear, Mother Bear kissed them everyone from 16-year-old Franz to little Rob, Hal kept the tip of her nose for his own particular kisses, and then they trooped up to bed. The light of the shaded lamp that burned in the nursery shone softly on a picture hanging at the foot of Nat's bed. There were several others on the walls, but the boy thought there must be something peculiar about this one, for it had a graceful frame of moss and cones about it, and on a little bracket underneath stood a vase of wild flowers freshly gathered from the spring woods. It was the most beautiful picture of them all, and Nat lay looking at it, dimly feeling what it meant, and wishing he knew all about it. "That's my picture," said a little voice in the room. Nat popped up his head, and there was Demi in his nightgown pausing on his way back from Aunt Jo's chamber, whither he had gone to get a cot for a cut finger. "What is he doing to the children?" asked Nat. "That is Christ, the good man, and he is blessing the children. Don't you know about him?" said Demi, wondering. "Not much, but I'd like to, he looks so kind," answered Nat, whose chief knowledge of the good man consisted in hearing his name taken in vain. "I know all about it, and I like it very much, because it is true," said Demi. "Who told you?" "My grandpa, he knows everything, and tells the best stories in the world. I used to play with his big books, and make bridges, and railroads, and houses, when I was a little boy," began Demi. "How old are you now?" asked Nat, respectfully. "Most 10. You know a lot of things, don't you?" "Yes, you see my head is pretty big, and grandpa says it will take a good deal to fill it, so I keep putting pieces of wisdom into it as fast as I can," returned Demi, in his quaint way. Nat laughed, and then said soberly, "Tell on, please." And Demi gladly told on without pause or punctuation. "I found a very pretty book one day and wanted to play with it, but grandpa said I mustn't, and showed me the pictures, and told me about them, and I liked the stories very much, all about Joseph and his bad brothers, and the frogs that came up out of the sea, and dear little Moses in the water, and ever so many more lovely ones, but I liked about the good man best of all, and grandpa told it to me so many times that I learned it by heart, and he gave me this picture so I shouldn't forget, and it was put up here once when I was sick, and I left it for other sick boys to see." "What makes him bless the children?" asked Nat, who found something very attractive in the chief figure of the group. "Because he loved them." "Were they poor children?" asked Nat, wistfully. "Yes, I think so. You see, some haven't got hardly any clothes on, and the mothers don't look like rich ladies. He liked poor people, and was very good to them. He made them well, and helped them, and told rich people they must not be cross to them, and they loved him dearly, dearly," cried Ami, with enthusiasm.
"Was he rich?"
"Oh no. He was born in a barn, and was so poor he hadn't any house to live in when he grew up, and nothing to eat sometimes, but what people gave him, and he went round preaching to everybody, and trying to make them good, till the bad men killed him."
"What for?"
And Nat sat up in his bed to look and listen, so interested was he in this man who cared for the poor so much. "I'll tell you all about it, Aunt Jo won't mind," and Demi settled himself on the opposite bed, glad to tell his favorite story to so good a listener. Nursey peeped in to see if Nat was asleep, but when she saw what was going on, she slipped away again, and went to Mrs. Bear, saying with her kind face full of motherly emotion, "Will the dear lady come and see a pretty sight?" It's Nat listening with all his heart to Demi telling the story of the Christ child, like a little white angel as he is. Mrs. Bear had meant to go and talk with Nat a moment before he slept, for she had found that a serious word spoken at this time often did much good. But when she stole to the nursery door, and saw Nat eagerly drinking in the words of his little friends, while Demi told the sweet and solemn story as it had been taught him, speaking softly as he sat with his beautiful eyes fixed on the tender face above them, her own filled with tears, and she went silently away, thinking to herself, "Demi is unconsciously helping the poor boy better than I can, I will not spoil it by a single word." The murmur of the childish voice went on for a long time, as one innocent heart preached that great sermon to another, and no one hushed it. When it ceased at last, and Mrs. Bear went to take away the lamp, Demi was gone and Nat fast asleep, lying with his face toward the picture, as if he had already learned to love the good man who loved little children,
and was a faithful friend to the poor. The boy's face was very placid, and as she looked at it she felt that if a single day of care and kindness had done so much, a year of patient cultivation would surely bring a grateful harvest from this neglected garden, which was already sown with the best of all seed by the little missionary in the nightgown. Chapter 4. Stepping Stones. When Matt went into school on Monday morning, he quaked inwardly, for now he thought he should have to display his ignorance before them all. But Mr. Bear gave him a seat in the deep window, where he could turn his back on the others, and Franz heard him say his lessons there, so no one could hear his blunders or see how he blotted his copybook. He was truly grateful for this, and toiled away so diligently that Mr. Bear said, smiling, when he saw his hot face and inky fingers, "Don't work so hard, my boy, you will tire yourself out, and there is time enough. But I must work hard, or I can't catch up with the others. They know heaps, and I don't know anything," said Nat, who had been reduced to a state of despair by hearing the boys recite their grammar, history, and geography with what he thought amazing ease and accuracy. "You know a good many things which they don't," said Mr. Bear, sitting down beside him, while Franz led a class of small students through the intricacies of the multiplication table. "Do I?" And Nat looked utterly incredulous. "Yes, for one thing, you can keep your temper, and Jack, who is quick at numbers, cannot. That is an excellent lesson, and I think you have learned it well. Then, you can play the violin, and not one of the lads can, though they wanted to do it very much. But, best of all, Nat, you really care to learn something, and that is half the battle. It seems hard at first, and you will feel discouraged, but plod away, and things will get easier and easier as you go on." Nat's face had brightened more and more as he listened, for, small as the list of his learning was, it cheered him immensely to feel that he had anything to fall back upon. "Yes, I can keep my temper, father's beating taught me that, and I can fiddle, though I don't know where the Bay of Biscay is," he thought, with a sense of comfort impossible to express. Then he said aloud, and so earnestly that Demi heard him, "I do want to learn, and I will try. I never went to school, but I couldn't help it, and if the fellows don't laugh at me, I guess I'll get on first rate. You and the lady are so good to me." "They shan't laugh at you. If they do, I'll tell them not to," cried Demi, quite forgetting where he was. The class stopped in the middle of 7 times 9, and everyone looked up to see what was going on. Thinking that a lesson in learning to help one another was better than arithmetic just then, Mr. Bear told them about Nat, making such an interesting and touching little story out of it that the good-hearted lads all promised to lend him a hand, and felt quite honored to be called upon to impart their stores of wisdom to the chap who fiddled so capitally. This appeal established the right feeling among them, and Nat had few hindrances to struggle against, for everyone was glad to give him a boost up the ladder of learning. Till he was stronger, much study was not good for him, however, and Mrs. Joe found various amusements in the house for him while others were at their books. But his garden was his best medicine, and he worked away like a beaver, preparing his little farm, sowing his beans, watching eagerly to see them grow, and rejoicing over each green leaf and slender stalk that shot up and flourished in the warm spring weather. Never was a garden more faithfully hoed. Mr. Bear really feared that nothing would find time to grow. Nat kept up such a stirring of the soil, so he gave him easy jobs in the flower garden or among the strawberries, where he worked and hummed as busily as the bees booming all about him. "This is the crop I like best," Mrs. Bear used to say, as she pinched the once thin cheeks, now getting plump and ruddy, or stroked the bent shoulders that were slowly straightening up with healthful work, good food, and the absence of that heavy burden, poverty. Demi was his little friend, Tommy his patron, and Daisy the comforter of all his woes, for, though the children were younger than he, his timid spirit found a pleasure in their innocent society, and rather shrunk from the rough sports of the elder lads. Mr. Lawrence did not forget him, but sent clothes and books, music and kind messages, and now and then came out to see how his boy was getting on, or took him into town to a concert, on which occasions Nat felt himself translated into the seventh heaven of bliss, for he went to Mr. Lawrence's great house, saw his pretty wife and little fairy of a daughter, had a good dinner, and was made so comfortable that he talked and dreamed of it for days and nights afterward. It takes so little to make a child happy that it is a pity, in a world so full of sunshine and pleasant things, that there should be any wistful faces, empty hands, or lonely little hearts. Feeling this, the bears gathered up all the crumbs they could find to feed their flock of hungry sparrows, for they were not rich, except in charity. Many of Mrs. Joe's friends who had nurseries sent her their toys, of which their children so soon tired, and in mending these Nat found an employment that just suited him. He was very neat and skillful with those slender fingers of his, and passed many a rainy afternoon with his gum bottle, paint box,
and knife, repairing furniture, animals, and games, while Daisy was dressmaker to the dilapidated dolls. As fast as the toys were mended, they were put carefully away in a certain drawer which was to furnish forth a Christmas tree for all the poor children of the neighborhood, that being the way the Plumfield boys celebrated the birthday of him who loved the poor and blessed the little ones. Demi was never tired of reading and explaining his favorite books, and many a pleasant hour did they spend in the old willow, reveling over Robinson Crusoe, Arabian Nights, Edgeworth's Tales, and the other dear immortal stories that will delight children for centuries to come. This opened a new world to Nat, and his eagerness to see what came next in the story helped him on till he could read as well as anybody, and felt so rich and proud with his new accomplishment, that there was danger of his being as much of a bookworm as Demi. Another helpful thing happened in a most unexpected and agreeable manner. Several of the boys were in business, as they called it, for most of them were poor, and knowing that they would have their own way to make by and by, the Bears encouraged any efforts at independence. Tommy sold his eggs, Jack speculated in livestock, Franz helped in the teaching, and was paid for it, Ned had a taste for carpentry, and a turning lathe was set up for him in which he turned all sorts of useful or pretty things, and sold them, while Demi constructed watermills, whirligigs, and unknown machines of an intricate and useless nature, and disposed of them to the boys. "Let him be a mechanic if he likes," said Mr. Bear. "Give a boy a trade, and he is independent. Work is wholesome, and whatever talent these lads possess, be it for poetry or plowing, it shall be cultivated and made useful to them if possible." So, when Nat came running to him one day to ask with an excited face, "Can I go and fiddle for some people who are to have a picnic in our woods? They will pay me, and I'd like to earn some money as the other boys do, and fiddling is the only way I know how to do it." Mr. Bear answered readily, "Go, and welcome. It is an easy and a pleasant way to work, and I am glad it is offered you." Nat went, and did so well that when he came home he had $2 in his pocket, which he displayed with intense satisfaction, as he told how much he had enjoyed the afternoon, how kind the young people were, and how they had praised his dance music, and promised to have him again. "It is so much nicer than fiddling in the street, for then I got none of the money, and now I have it all, and a good time besides. I'm in business now as well as Tommy and Jack, and I like it ever so much," said Nat, proudly patting the old pocketbook, and feeling like a millionaire already. He was in business truly, for picnics were plenty as summer opened, and Nat's skill was in great demand. He was always at liberty to go if lessons were not neglected, and if the picnickers were respectable young people. For Mr. Bear explained to him that a good plain education is necessary for everyone, and that no amount of money should hire him to go where he might be tempted to do wrong. Nat quite agreed to this, and it was a pleasant sight to see the innocent-hearted lad go driving away in the gay wagons that stopped at the gate for him, or to hear him come fiddling home tired but happy, with his well-earned money in one pocket, and some goodies from the feast for Daisy or little Ted, whom he never forgot. "I'm going to save up till I get enough to buy a violin for myself, and then